This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Maybe You'll Never Cry Again, written and read by Bernie Mac. My name is Bernard Jeffrey McCullough, but people know me as Bernie Mac. My mama, God rest her soul, she used to call me Beanie. She used to say, "Don't you worry about Beanie. Beanie gonna be just fine. Beanie gonna surprise everyone." Woman believed in me way before I believed in myself. I love my mama with all my heart. Well, I was born October 5th, 1957, on the south side of Chicago, in Woodlawn area, a neighborhood that hasn't changed much in 45 years. Our house was on 66 in Blackstone, but the city tore it down when the rats took over. We moved to a new place on 69th and Morgan in Inglewood, right above a church called Burning Bush Baptist Church. Two stories, red brick building. My grandfather was a deacon of the church, and I think he got a real good deal on the place, so we packed up, and my mother Mary and her sister Evelyn and my oldest brother Daryl, my grandparents Lorraine and Thurman, and little me. Somewhere along the line, maybe during the move to our new digs, we lost Daddy. Well, we were poor. You know how you tell if you're a poor person. You look in the fridge and there's nothing there but bologna. You were talking serious poor. But that bologna was good. We used to fry it till it made a black circle form at the edges. Then roll it like a hot dog and eat it real slow. Make it last, you know. Be chewing with your eyes closed, telling yourself, never, never taste nothing so good. Yeah, we was poor. But here's the thing, I didn't think nothing about it. I thought we was just like everybody else. I thought life was good. I thought how sweet life is. 3-4 years old, I would go outside in the afternoon and see if anyone my side was around. Maybe me and my friends would kick an old can up and down the sidewalk till the neighbors told us to shut up, yell at us. You know, that was the neighborhood. Nobody calling out, "Hey, Burn, wash your hand." Boy, a piano teacher was on our way over. We didn't have play dates in our neighborhood. We learned to entertain ourselves. I used to have long conversation with the living room walls. I used to be in the room talking to myself, doing voices, and my grandma said, "Who you talking to, boy?" Shuffling her ankles, swollen real bad. You know, I say nothing. She said, "You sassing me, boy?" I said, "No, ma'am." She said, "Wait till your grandpa come home. I'm gonna tell him how you're sassing. You getting it. He's gonna whoop your ass." See, in my family, we learned respect. That's in my day. Adults were in control. There were rules. And by God, we had to follow them. Every time mama sat down the law, she said, "I know you don't like it, Bean, but I know you're gonna be mad at me, but life ain't no popularity contest." When I was old enough to understand what she meant, about 5 years old, she started trying to give me her wisdom, her life philosophy. I call it spitting venom. See, if I got angry, she would tell me to get over it. "Only person you're hurting is yourself," she would say. If you did something she considered too stupid for words, she'd shake her head and look at you seriously disappointed. "Act like you got some sense, boy," she'd say. "Maybe one day it'll come true." It did come true. Of course, it was a long time coming. See, one night, I remember a long time ago, I came in, I was sitting on the stoop, and I found my mama in front of the TV crying. And I was a little kid, you know, you're a little kid, you see your mama crying, you start to cry. I climbed into her lap, and I was holding her hand. I took my hand, and I started wiping the tears from her cheek with my little bitty hand. "Mama," I asked her, "why are you crying?" She said, "Nothing, Bean. Sometimes I just have sad thoughts." Well, she was looking at the TV, and this black guy was talking to Ed Sullivan. I look at him, and I can hear a few words, and I can see right away that it's now the man who I was looking at was Bill Cosby. And Bill Cosby was doing his little monologue and everything. I saw my mother. She began to cry and laugh at the same time. So when you see your mother cry, you know you begin to cry. So at that time, I saw and I said to myself, I said, "Wow, that's power." So I looked at my mama and I saw how happy she began to look. And I told her, I said, "Mama, That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a comedian. She said, oh, that's good, son. I said, you know why? She said, why? So maybe I'll never see you cry again. She started hugging me so tight, I could hardly breathe. Oh, she kept looking at me. She said, my little baby, my little baby. I love you so much. You just don't know how much I love you, Beanie. See, at that time, I had some direction. I was going to be a comedian. I practiced it at home. I took my talent to school. See, I was a class clown, always practicing doing something stupid. The teacher would ask the class, what is 7 times 14? And I would say, why are you asking us? You the teacher. All the kids would bust up laughing. Well, she didn't like it one bit. You know, she called Mama. You know, and Bernie knew the answers better than most of the other kids, but he liked to say things wrong. He thought it was funny. Mama didn't like it much herself. She used to say, it's a shame you're born stupid, Bern. But when you practice it, I got a problem with that. I bowed my head like I was supposed to, and I said, yes, ma'am, Mama. When your granddaddy get home, I'm going to whoop your butt. See, when you grow up, the world start changing, or maybe you just see it the way you see it, even if you're only watching Leave It to Beaver. See, one night at dinner, I asked my mama. Mama, I said, Mama, why we poor? She said, don't mean nothing, she said. You be proud, son. You hold your head high. My grandmother whacked my elbows off the table. It was like a sneak attack. I almost fell clean off the chair. What'd I say to you about your elbows on the table, she asked. But she ain't want no answer. Use your manners, boy. We're poor, but manners don't cost nothing. Good manners tell people who you are. My grandmother always had sayings like that. Sayings ran in my family. On a bad day, she'd say, life is like a heavyweight fight, Bernie. Protect yourself at all times. On a good day, it was beautiful morning, ain't it, son? I got another crack at it this morning. Another chance to improve myself. Boy, we was in church, man, so much, man, on Sunday came around. Boy, you put on your starchy shirt and marched downstairs. Boy, it was crowded. You knew the world was full of sinners, everybody hugging and kissing like they lost their relatives. When you saw them only last night, they were dancing in the middle of the street drunk, cussing. Then when you go inside the regular pew, the first row, you suffer through all that singing and praying and hollering. Then Grandpa will come up, his voice rolling like thunder, shaking his fists. Sinners! Sinners! One day we had a banquet at church, and one of the guest deacons said to me, Bernie, I hear you think you're funny. I said, pretty funny, I said. 8 years old I was. I already had a reputation. It was 1966. Cosby was going strong. Richard Pryor was a rising star. And Bernie Mac was about to test the waters. Deacon made me stand up in front where everybody could see me. I looked out at all those stony faces. I tell you something I learned early on. Black people are tough. They want to be entertained, but I can see it in their eyes. They don't think you're funny, boy. Nothing about being no kid. If you ain't funny, you just ain't funny. I waited for them to quiet down, and I started. Boy, my family looking dead at me. My grandpa, he would always just say things four times. Go on, do it. I sat there and I waited for him to get through telling me to go on and do it. And I started. And I started mimicking my grandfather. I had his voice down pat. The whole church looked at me stunned. And I said, this is a routine about my grandmother and grandfather sitting at the dinner table. And I said, woman, you better hand me that gravy before I punk you on top of your head. She said, you ain't gonna do a doggone thing to me. I said, let me tell you something. You better quiet as good. Lord is our enemy. Quiet is our friend. And my grandmother came up and she snatched me. She took me to the back and she spanked me. The church was looking at me because they didn't know if they should laugh or cry. And my grandmother brought me back with tears in my eyes and she said, now you finish it and you bet not do it again. Well, I stood there and I looked at the audience. They were looking dead at me. That's when I realized that the laugh was so important to me. I looked around to my left. I looked around to my right. And I did it again. Woman, I said, hand me no doggone gravy, no biscuit. If you don't, I'm gonna bunk you on top of your head. She said, boy, I'm telling you, you're asking for it. Now the church fell out laughing. That was the beginning of Bernie Mac. Well, the church was laughing. I mean, they're hollering and screaming. I looked at my grandma. She's not laughing. I looked at my grandfather. His mouth dropped. All those people. I'm gonna tell you, she banged me up. She beat me down. It hurt like hell, but I don't care because everybody was laughing. You pull on my ear all you want, Grandma. It was worth it. It didn't hurt me. I learned a valuable lesson. I learned that I wanted to be a comedian. My grandma was laughing and she was telling it to somebody else the next day. I heard her on the phone. Girl, she said, he sounds just like me too. I couldn't believe it. He did it again. Oh, girl. Yeah, did I whoop him? I sure did. I tried to kill him. Oh, girl, you should have seen it. He sure had us down pat. I was proud. See, in school, I was funny, too. I couldn't help myself. I like making people laugh. Teachers would call my mom and complain. Principals talked to me all the time, ministers, coach, school janitors even. Everybody was trying to talk sense into Bernie Mac, but I wasn't listening. My teacher, Miss Ford, you want to be funny, she said. I say, I guess. She said, okay, I'll tell you what you do. Why don't you come and amuse us? Stand in front of the class and tell us a story. I said, what kind of story you want to hear? And all the kids started rambling off, talking about, I want to hear a scary story. I want to hear a nice story. Well, I started telling the story right off the top of my head. 35 minutes went in. I didn't crack a breath. Teacher looked at me. The kids were silent. They were enjoying every minute, listening to my every word, all my expressions. I was doing the sounds of the squirrels, the thunder, the rain. They were listening. And my teacher looked at me and she said, how come a guy who does not do his homework, does not pay attention, has that much vision? I shrugged my shoulders and I said, She said, sit down. Everyone looked at me. I sat down, and at that moment, I was kind of embarrassed. I was kind of embarrassed because I never expected what I got. I never did it for attention. I thought I did, but I learned something else about myself. Well, I got a reputation once again. The whole school knew I told stories, and teachers used that to quiet the students down. When they got a little rowdy, she would always say, hey, if y'all don't be quiet, I'm not gonna let Bernie tell a story. I never knew I was planning on telling a story, but it got to the point where she would use me as ammunition. So one day she gathered all the teachers in the hallway telling them that she had a student that could tell stories and she wanted them to hear. Well, what happened? All the classes started combined with ours on Friday for recreational day, and the principal and the teachers and everybody would clam up in the room and everyone would circle around me while I told stories. And I would tell stories right off the top of my head. Next thing you know, the story was so good, time used to fly by. When the teacher said, well, hold on, the bell would ring. I guess that's it. Everyone would say, oh, I'm sorry, school's over. And I would get my coat and everything, and the kids would always say, finish telling me the story. I felt the power in the stories. Well, you know, it feels good to be popular because we all want to be loved. You know, and some people, well, they need it more than others. Some people are hungry for it. I might as well admit it, here and now. I should be one of those people. At home, the phone would ring, I would jump to my feet. That's for me. Mail would come, I'll run over and say, any mail for me? It was tough. I guess I went in and out in that zone of wanting and knowing what I wanted. My brother Daryl, he was rough. I mean, he was mean. I never could figure it out. We had the same mother, brought up exactly the same way, but you never know it. He was a good-looking man, solid, strong, fifth-degree black belt in karate. But there was something wrong inside. See, he was full of anger. Came off him in waves. Any little thing, pow, set him off. You know, still when we were a little kid, you loved your big brother, and I loved Daryl. Sometime, unconditionally. He was a man 10 years older than me. Powerful. I wanted him to love me, too. But sometime at that time, I felt he didn't. Now that I think back on it, though, it was almost like he hated me. Every chance he got, he would beat me. Beat me till he drew blood. A lot of times to throw up and piss and shit on myself. Sound kind of cruel, but that's what happened. Every blows, man, was devastating. And he would tell me, if you tell Mom, I'm going to kill you. Something was evil inside that boy. Daryl went to war. I was in grade school. We all prayed for him to survive. All our prayers was answered. He came back home from war, anger, and more evil than ever. He moved out and got a job at the post office. I missed him more than ever. I can't explain it. Man did nothing but hurt me and beat me up physically and emotionally, but still I loved him. What did I know? I was a child. I wanted attention. I looked for other ways to get it. I would go into the store and steal candy bars and ditch school. I would go down to the project and break windows. I kind of sort of wanted to get caught. I wanted to be noticed. And then one day, 12 years old, I got noticed. Real good. Went to the store and stole some baseball. I never made it out the door. They called the cops and wound up putting me in the cell. A few hours later, they let me out and I found my mama out there waiting. And Lord, you should have saw the look on her face, the pain, the disappointment. I didn't know if I wanted to run or be assassinated. At that moment, I wanted to die. The whole way back home, she didn't say a word. Then we got a half a block from the home. She stopped and turned to me and looked me face to face. If you a bad beanie, if you go bad on me, son, I won't be there for you anymore. You understand me? I'm not coming out to get you again. We never again spoke of that day in our house. There was nothing to say. Sometimes less is more. It worked for me. I remember one day my brother came and he picked me up and he took me to the Regal Theater where he had a young band and they were playing. I think they were opening act. The Regal Theater was the answer to the Apollo. I sat there. He made me become a stagehand, set up the stage. I sat in the back and I saw a lot of people walk through. I saw Moms Mabley. I saw Pig Meat. I saw a few groups, Leroy Hudson. You know, a lot of popular Motown sound. I was so small, you know, and ignorant, I didn't pay any attention. I kept setting up the band and everyone was, you know, was hooping and hollering, smoking cigarettes, cussing and talking all loud. I was in my own world. Well, I sat there and I was backstage and they ran me to the store and it's this Daryl's brother. I started going to the store, getting Orange Crushes, Suzy Q's and cigarettes. All the place was hot. They were sliding across the floor and people were screaming and dancing in the aisles. I didn't pay any attention. Until one day, I sat there and I stared and all these people were coming in and out and some music was playing and a lady was on the stage. She said, come here. And I was backstage and she told me to come here and I came out and she started dancing. I started dancing. And I flipped and turned and split and came back up. The crowd went mad. Oh, that's all I needed to hear. Shit. Oh, I was shaking my ass. Yes, sir. Shook it to the east. I shook it to the west. Oh, that was a happy moment. That's when I knew the stage was mine. Every Saturday, my Saturdays was always busy. You know, I did things for the church. I cleaned up the backyard. I ran errands for the neighbors. I stood at the store and I delivered groceries. And my brother from time to time used to take me and I go and listen and watch him rehearse. And I used to watch him dance and he was something else. I learned a lot of things from him. I remember I learned a lot of things from him, my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, just by listening and being in the corner, just staring. I remember my mother came to me one day. She told me my father called. They said he was coming over. Well, I really never really saw my father that much. And I was excited. So I sat down on the couch and I asked my mother, could I dress up? She said, sure, you can dress up. I put on a little blue suit, Vaseline all on my face, part on the side, and I waited. 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. My mother says, son, he's not coming. Take your clothes off. I started to cry a little bit. I said, he is coming, Mama, he is, because you wanted to believe. Every time someone tells you something, especially a grown man, I was taught to believe that they were with their bond, that it was true. My mother looked at me, she shaked her head, she saw a little tear come down my face. She said, okay, you keep your suit on just a few minutes more, but then afterwards, I want you to take it off. Well, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. My mama said, take your suit off, son, he's not coming. I began to wail again. She said, listen, I'm going to the store, and when I come back, you're going to take that suit off and go to bed. He's not coming. My mama walked out, stole across the street. She walked out. Seconds later, I hear somebody come up the stairs, knocked on the door. I opened the door real slow, and there my father was in the doorway. And he said, Junior, Bernard Jr., 6'3", 200-some pounds, smooth, silk, spoke well. He said, Mr. Mag. And of course, I'm Daddy. I ran toward him. He picked me up. He was so strong, and I started to beat on his chest. What took you so long waiting on you? He looked at me. He said, son, come to the window. He took me over to the window, and he said, look across the street. I looked, and he said, what do you see? I said, I see some people standing, and I see somebody fighting over there. And he said, no, look at that car. You see that car? I said, yes. He said, that's where I was, son. I was out purchasing you a car. I said, what? He said, that's right. He said, Daddy bought you a car. Boy, I smiled and I squeezed his neck real hard. He said, son, you know what? Daddy spent all his money buying you that car. Do you know if anyone have any money laying around? I can get some gas and take you out and let you drive it. I said, I got some money. He said, you do? I said, yes, sir. I ran in there and I got my piggy bank and I cracked it wide open. I think I had maybe $40-something in there. I came back. I brought it to him. He looked. His eyes widened. He said, oh, my God. Where you get all this money at, son? I said, I saved my money. You know, it's for Mama, so I'm going to buy Mama a house, you know. He looked at me. He said, well, son, I'll be right back. I'm going to put some gas in the car, and you and I going to go for a ride. Boy, I was happy. My father walked out the door. A few seconds later, I heard my mother coming up. Soon as she hit the door, she said, Beanie, come on, let me take the clothes off. Time for you to go to bed. I said, no, Mama, I can't go to bed. She said, I don't have time to play with you, son. Take your clothes off. You go on to bed. I said, no, Mama, you're not listening. You're not listening. I said, Daddy came here. She said, no, your father is not coming. He's not here. I said, yes, he is. I said, Mama, he is. He bought me a car. And she looked and she saw my piggy bank was cracked open. And she said, oh, who did that? I said, Mama, that's what I'm trying to tell you. I said, look, Daddy bought me that car. And I broke the piggy bank because he said he needed gas. My mother shut down the stairs. I couldn't even finish my sentence. And I heard my mother and father battling down the street. She called them. And they were humbugging. I ran down. I grabbed my father's leg as he tried to hit my mother. My mother hit him back. And he, in the midst of hitting her, picked me up and slung me against the fence. Wow, my mother really got fired up then. The fight was on. He finally knocked my mother down and ran. And my mother, she held me. And I was crying, and she wouldn't let me see her crying. She just told me, "Son, I hated for you to see that." And ever since then, I said, I will never treat a woman like my father treated her. So I grew up in a neighborhood where there was always something. We didn't have the luxury of video games, computers, and things of that nature. We had to build and make our own fun, our own games. It was an abandoned house down the street, and my buddies used to always go down there, and we saw the landlord putting a padlock on the door. And I asked him, I said, "Wow, man, some couches and tables in there." And he said, "Well, they left." And I said, "What they going to do with it?" He said, "Well, I don't know, they probably sent them out." Well, he got in the car and he left. Sure enough, I picked the lock. We had a basement we used to hang out. And I used to kick the door open. They used to lock it. I kick it open. And I got the couches and the tables. And I got a little television. I made a little hideout for us. Before we would go down there. We never did drugs or nothing like that, you know. Every now and then, the big guys come down there and they drink and smoke cigarettes. But for the most part, we danced, played music, a little kissing with the neighborhood girls. We was cool. I never did drugs, never. I think I tried marijuana a couple of times, and my brother laced it with some angel dust, tore my heart up, beat my chest up. I was on medication for 3 years. I never did it again. We had wine heads, people who drank wine, and you would find them laying against the fence. We would pick them up because we knew who they were and take them to their home and clean them up. We didn't have crackheads and junkies. Junkies were ashamed to be seen because they stuck out like a sore thumb. Brothers knifing each other. People had hand-to-hand combats. They called them humbugs. They had fist fights. Well, they fought to the death, damn near. Those were the days. Kids today didn't have that. They grew up too fast. They can't take pressure. Can't get hit in the jaw. We had a rough, hard neighborhood, but still, I thought we had a good thing. Those was hardships. Couldn't wait to get grown, work on cars on Saturdays with your buddies in somebody's garage, ran errands for the neighbors. Somebody got sick, my grandmother always cooked. I had to go cut their grass or shovel their snow. We had rules. I thought they were strict, but it was discipline, it was order. We had to respect our elders. We looked at them in the eye, we said, "Thank you, ma'am." "No, ma'am." "Appreciate that." We took out the garbage, we had chores, we walked the dog. We cleaned the glass and cleaned the paper from in front of our doors and other people's doors. Sunday was church. Couldn't play games, couldn't listen to the radio. Couldn't play cards, couldn't play Monopoly because they had dice. We prayed, we sang, and we taught respect. I couldn't wait to get old because I thought those days was awful. They made me sick. We cranked, we moaned. But you know what? Without those days, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. In about 1973, I think it was about 14, we moved out south to a bigger and better house. Real nice neighborhood. It was like the suburbs. Boy, you hear the crickets, grass. We had grass. I wasn't used to that. We were used to dirt mixed with glass and rocks. Before that, man, I remember my mother was in the room and I had something to tell her. And I opened the door and I slid the door open and I said, "Mama, mama." And my mama's bra was on the couch. My mother had cancer for 7 years and she never told anybody. And one of her breasts was missing. And she had a little breast pad in her bra. I looked. My mother had both her arms crossed across her chest. But she kept doing what she was doing, kind of, sort of, you know. I was in awe. I'm looking, and I said, Mama, he said, close the door, son. Close the door. I said, but Mama, what's going on? She said, son, close the door. I backed out. I closed the door. I went to the back. I was stunned. And I asked my grandmother, and I said, Grandma, I saw my mother and her breast is missing. I said, what's wrong? She said, go ask your mother. I walked back toward the front. I knocked on the door. My mother was fully dressed then, and she said, come in. I slid the door open, and she said, now, Beanie, what is it? And I said, Mom, what happened to your chest? She said, none of your business, and walked past me and closed the door. My mom was always tired in those days. She never cranked and moaned. We had dinner, we sit all in front of the TV, and sometimes she would nod off. We cover up and let her just lie there. I watched all the television show. I watched Gunsmoke, Lost in Space, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, The Fugitive, Marcus Welby, Perry Mason, Twilight Zone. You know, television was a higher form of education for me. I learned about how to structure a show, how to write a show, how to deal with a plot, how to solve, you know, the difference between suspense and surprise. I learned how to make stories unfold. But comedy and comedians had a special place in my heart. I used to study Bill Cosby, check out his moves, practice them in the mirror. Flip Wilson had a show, too, started back in the 70s. Red Fox, oh, I should listen to his album. You know, he had an edge on him. Well, I liked him more than ever. Bill Cosby, you know, he was the people's choice. But you didn't see too many black people on TV, so I just loved him. Him, Sammy Davis Jr., Sidney Poitier, and Diane Carroll. Well, like I say, I didn't know my mother was sick. Within a year moving to the new house, my mother took for the worse. I guess when I really found out was right before we moved and I saw my mother and my aunt and them pulling up, and they literally had to pick my mother out of the car. I pulled my auntie to the side and I asked her, I said, what's wrong with my mama? And she said, what they didn't tell you? And I said, tell me what? She said, I'm gonna let them tell you. I turned to my mother and I saw them. Her hair was laid back, eyes going in the back of her head. I guess then I really knew I was going to lose my mother. I walked down the alley. My buddies pat me on the back, and I started to cry, and they asked me what's wrong. I told them I think my mother's going to die. Everybody tried to console me, but you know what? I went and played baseball. I hit 3 home runs, stole 2 bases, and I made a winning catch. I played like a man possessed. Everybody kept looking at me and saying, how did he play like that and his mama died? Word got around the neighborhood that my mother was dying. That quick. My mother was rushed to the hospital a couple of days later, and they gave my mother 24 hours to live. I remember they came to get me, my uncles and aunt came to pick me up and took me to Cook County Hospital. That's when I saw my entire family, and they finally told me that my mother had cancer. And I saw her on the bed, and I saw her dying. I don't know what I felt, but I know I wanted to die, too. I started walking, and everyone was calling my name. I kept walking. They had to grab me. I wasn't walking for attention. I truly wanted to die. Because I finally, at that time, realized I was losing my best friend. I was losing my life. All those years, my mother was preaching and practicing, teaching me and telling me the right things. And I never paid them any attention because I was too ignorant. All of a sudden, everything hit me like a ton of bricks. Wow. My mother went from 170 pounds to 70-something pounds. My mother didn't die that night. Matter of fact, she came home the following week. We moved 2 weeks later into this beautiful house, which was like the suburbs. They had a room for my mom, where she had a nice view and a nice backyard. We had a garage, and we had upstairs. Boy, I thought we was leaving the Beaver. I always wanted a home with upstairs. That was fascinating to me. My mother had a nurse to come and pick her and clean her up and, you know, feed her. I remember I used to feed my mother through a straw. One day it was nice. We had my mother on our hospital bed. We rolled out. And I saw them pick my mother up in a bandage on her back. A real big, large bandage, about maybe 10 by 12, covering her back. It fell off, and you could see a heart beating from her back. Wow, almost dropped. And I saw the pain on my mother's face. She said,
Hurry up. Roll me over. I'm gonna be dead. Roll me over.
My grandfather told me leave, son, because he saw me. And I said, I'm not leaving. I'm gonna stay here. He said, you can't handle it. When he said that, something came over me. I said, I can handle any damn thing. I don't know why I said it, but I did. And I went to pick my mother up by her bed, and they told me, stand back. And I said, I got it. My mother said, put it down. Please, Lord, put it down. They didn't want me to see it, you know, 14 going on 15. They didn't want me to see that. But something came over me. I wanted to see it. They made me go outside. I went outside and I saw them struggling to take my mother through the back to get her some sunshine in the backyard. That's what my grandfather told me. He said, you know your mother and your father wasn't married. Another blow. I said, what? He said, yeah, they weren't married. He said, we just thought you should know. Well, hours later, my father, he comes over to visit my mom in her cancerous state. Smooth, clean, suave. I'm staring at him, just watching him work. Throwing his charm all around like his quarters and dimes, you know. I'm watching this punk, and he's sitting there for a couple of hours. He's standing on my mother, feeding her juice. And my mother, she's a skeleton by now. Stands up, pat her on the head, and said, I'm getting ready to go now, and I'll try to call you tomorrow. Like my mother gonna answer the phone, you know. He come to me, he said, son, you want to walk me to the bus stop? I said, sure. Started walking to the bus stop. We began to talk, and I asked him, I said, let me ask you something. He said, you son, you can ask me anything. I said, are you married to my mother? He said, what? I said, you heard the question. Are you married to my mother? He looked at me and stopped. And he said, I think that's a question you should ask your mother. Go ask your mother. And I said, fuck, I'm asking you. He looked at me. I said, my mother's dying. How the hell am I asking my mother? I said, now you tell me, are you married to my mother? He looked at me and he said, some philosophical answer. He said, son, what does it matter? The blood you have in your veins, the same blood that runs through mine. You are my son. Whether you like it or not, the bus was coming. That was his out. He said, let's finish the conversation. I'll give you a call. I said, bitch, get your punk ass on the bus and don't ever call me again. He looked at me. He said, what? He stepped towards me, but I've already been beat up by my brother Daryl, so I knew I could take anything he threw. So out of my mouth said, motherfucker, you heard me. Bus a move. I wasn't playing. My buddy was behind me looking and mouth dropped. He turned because I had a look on my face that I never really realized I could ever get. He got on the bus. He didn't look back. He didn't look at me again. I turned. My buddies came to me and they said, "Are you all?" I cut them off. I said, "Let's go play ball." I tore that basketball court up. It was almost like I was in another body. I had a look on my face for everyone. I knew I had it because everyone was looking like staying the hell away from me. But I was for no joke. That was a new move and a new instinct, a killer instinct that came out of Bernie Mac. Well, school started. My mother was in her room like a skeleton. I came downstairs getting ready to go to school. And I heard my mother's voice. She was talking. And I wondered who she was talking to. I knocked on the door, as I always do. I was taught to knock before you enter. My mother was laying in the hospital bed. I said, "Mama?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Who are you talking to?" She said, "Oh, I'm talking to my friend." I said, "Mama, you tired?" She said, "Yeah, I'm tired. I'm so tired." I said, "I'm getting ready to go to school, Mama." I said, "So I'll see you when I get back. I got to go to choir practice," because I was directed to choir. I kissed her on the forehead and she smiled. And she turned her little head and walked out the door. She died right there, right after I left. I went to school, they didn't tell me. I went to school and did my thing and went to my classes and went to basketball practice and I went back to my old neighborhood to Burning Bush. And everyone knew my mother was dead. When I got there, boy, I was clowning, laughing, and everybody was just looking at me. And my grandmother told him not to tell me. So me and my buddy Earl Tarver, he was a funny guy too. He called himself Bill Cosby. I was Richard Pryor. He was clowning. Something just came over me. I just felt something was wrong. And we was doing a song and we kept doing it over and over again because Earl kept clowning. And all of a sudden, I stood up and I said, "Earl, quit clowning. I got to go home. My family waiting on me." And everybody looked. Earl looked at me and he said, "Cool, man, cool." We sang the song and Brother Boy said, "Okay, that's it. You know, that's it. All right, rehearsal next Friday and we'll sing this song Sunday," and went through the schedule. Everyone was leaving, getting their stuff. No one said anything to me. Mr. and Mrs. Washington dropped me off from 69th and Morgan to 105th and Eberhardt. I'm clowning, doing voices, and telling them what happened in school and how I solved it. They're looking at each other, but they just amusing me, you know. I pulled up in front of my house and I saw all these cars, and I said, "Wow. It sure is a lot of cars in front of my house. Must be having a party." They didn't say anything. I got out the car and I thanked them so much and I offered them gas money. And as usual, they never took it, but that's the way I was taught. That's the way my mother always taught me. Pay your own way. If you don't have, do without. Take advantage of no one. Don't ever lie to yourself. All those things my mother always taught me. I went in the house, and sure enough, I had a packed house. And I came in, fired up. I'm the Mac man. "Hey, what's going on? I'm the Mac. It's here. Y'all got a party? Where's the food?" Everyone looking at me, and my grandfather walked up to me, and he said, "You hear what happened to your mother?" I said, "No." He said, "Your mother died this morning, right after you left for school." Wow. I went to the room where she was, and the hospital bed was gone. You still had that cancerous smell all in that area. I just kept seeing her face as she turned her head and said, "Yeah, I'm real tired. I'm talking to my friend." I went upstairs, and I sat on the bed, and my aunt and my cousins and everyone came over. But you know what? I wasn't sad, because my mother always told me, never waddle and self-pity. Stand up. Look forward. Don't look back. The more you cry, the less you piss. That was my mother always spitting that venom. I saw her face. Yeah, her lips was chapped. Her skull was dry. Her skin was cracked. The cancer ate her up. But that was my mama. But that started a friendship between me and my brother. Because my brother and I never, ever, ever had a friendship. I don't know why, but all of a sudden he tried to get close. He came over and he talked to me. He was getting ready for the funeral and everything, and he all of a sudden talked to me as if I was his friend. And you know what? I accepted it. Because it's been a long wait. Well, we went to the funeral. People came over, brought all kind of cakes and pies. And we go in and I see my mother. And I saw the heavy weight on my grandmother's face. She said nothing the whole time. But my brother stood up over my mother and just stood there. He used to call my mother Mary. I hated that. That's something to this day where I can't stand kids calling their parents by their name. That is a form of disrespect, something that I can never, ever deal and will never understand. But he stood there over my mother with his hat in his hand because he never did right by my mother. My mother wrote a 7-page letter to my aunt, her sister, explaining to her what she wanted her to do in the event of her death. And in that letter, she said, "Do not worry about Beanie. Beanie's going to be fine," she said. As I said earlier, she knew more than I did. But for my brother, she said, "Don't you lift a finger and don't you give him a dime. He's bad." My mother said that. My mother always said the truth. Grandma, too. I guess that's a page I took out of their notebook when they could see their own. My brother stood there once again the whole time. And we buried my mother and life went on. But my brother became my ghost. I look up in practice. My coach let me know that he was there. I used to go over to my girlfriend's house and be on the bus stop. He would pull up. I had a basketball game and I got into a scuffle and a couple of guys were going to jump me from the back. I had no idea. My brother told him I wouldn't try it. He was always there. But ironic as it may sound, the same day, same time, following year, my brother dropped dead. Heart attack. Kind of sort of like Bruce Lee. He had the same thing. Physical specimen. Chisel, had the heart of a lion. Mean. Could tear a wall down. But God said, "Let me tear your wall down." I think my brother was being paid back for the way he treated my mother. And that's a fear of mine. I'm a firm believer what goes around comes around. I'm a firm believer that you treat people bad, it'll come back to you. That's one reason it really motivated me to be a comedian. I find positive in the most negative spots. I've been beat up, beat down, threw up, robbed, and cheated. But still in my heart, I still find a reason to smile. My brother was dead, and my brother left everything to me. You figure that out. $20,000, brand new car that I never got a chance to drive. I never knew he felt the way he did about me. But one thing I learned about that, when you feel something like that, he waited too late to tell me. You figure it out. Well, I filled my time with sports and doing odd jobs around the neighborhood. I worked at Hillman's. I played basketball, baseball, box, and all that kind of stuff to keep my mind off my losses. I became a class clown. Standing in front of people was no problem. I met a lovely girl named Jerry Duncan who I, at that particular time, I fell deep in love with. I spent most of my time with her. On the weekends, her and my buddies, we would get together and go to parties, shows, and all that kind of stuff, and I would always be the amuser at the party. Standing up in front of people, entertaining people, was not a problem. Boy, I can dance, slide across the floor, and all that kind of stuff, but that was a way for me to clear my mind and stop thinking about my mother and her cracked lips and her thin shoulder and how she deteriorated in front of my eyes, about my brother who I thought was stronger than King Kong, how his heart stopped beating right in the middle of a sentence. No self-pity, though. Mama didn't like that. Yep, I took my dream and I practiced it and I took it someplace else. That summer, I worked at a youth program. You know, I was picking up garbage on the expressway. I was painting lines down the middle of the road. I was in summer school because I messed up my first 2 years in high school. I failed English. So I had to pick up the pieces if I wanted to graduate. I was in summer school, actually, when the news came to me about my brother. My other brother came and told me that he died. But before he told me, I stood up in front of the class and I said, in a few minutes, someone's going to walk through that door and I'm going to have to leave. I said, so pay attention. And right away, somebody walked through the door with a note. And Miss Walters looked at me and she said, you set this up. And the class went, oh, no. They said, you want him at the principal office. I stood up. I said, I told you. Didn't I tell you? I said, I'll be back, Miss Walters. I know you need me. I walked to the principal office and I saw my brother with his head down. He said, I want you to come go with me. I said, sure, let me go back and get my coat. I ran back, I walked through the door, and they said, oh, he's back. I said, no, no, I have to go and take care of some family business. No one can take care like me. Something happened in the family, I won't be back for about 4 or 5 days. I left the room, and I went there, and I greeted my brother on the step. He was walking real slow, and I said, man, what's up? He said, Bernie, you got to get strong again. I looked at his eyes, and I knew something was wrong, but I thought it was my grandmother. He said, Bernie, Daryl died this morning. Right away, I thought he was shot or killed. Had to. Told me he dropped dead, heart attack. I definitely couldn't believe that. That was a mystery to me. Well, once again, I went to school, and I occupied my mind. People used to look at me because they said I never act like anything happened. Boy, I used to always keep myself busy. I get up, I did something. Stayed in the gym, I ran all the time. And then all my little late nights, I stayed with my girlfriend Jerry. I left her house at 9:30, 10 o'clock because her father was a minister and they taught the same thing that I was under, respect. And I never disrespected her, because I always cared about her. She was headstrong. She was real smart, bossy, demanding. She wanted to be my mother, like most women, but I wasn't having it. But I was too ignorant to really understand what direction she was going to. Do this, do that. Come over here. Meet me at third period. Be in the lunchroom. Did you pay for the prom? Did you do that? That's how she was. Good people. But I was so ignorant and so young in mind, I didn't understand the pressure. I was too slow for her. She needed someone that was on the same path as she was. I was emerging into a clown. Laughed all the time. She said, you laugh too much. You're always telling jokes. Life is serious. You know, you don't take your grades serious. I'm in summer school. You failed English. I was D, 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 C, C, and I had an A, and that was in gym. But I was a bad student, not a terrible student. I said I was a bad student because I didn't put an effort, I didn't try. My interest was always somewhere else, but I knew the answers. I knew I was smart, but I didn't apply myself. And then I thought about what my mother says. Damn, shame, you're born stupid, but when you practice it, something's wrong. I got myself together. I think I went from 700 and something to 500 and something in my senior class. It wasn't so much of the number. It was so much of the effort. I was doing it for myself. 'Cause that's what my mama said to me. Don't do it for me. Do it for yourself. Well, sure enough, I graduated from high school with a new girlfriend. Jerry dumped me because I was too slow for her. I wasn't up to par. My grades was bad, and I was silly. Let's face it, you know, I was a silly young boy. She needed somebody who was, at that particular time, on her level. And I admit, y'all, there ain't no self-pity. I was a boy. So I met this girl named Rhonda. All my senior year, she was a friend of my buddy, Big Nigga, his girlfriend. We started eating lunch together and started hanging out, and we were just primarily friends. Well, time went on. I had a little self-hope. I was hoping Jerry reconsidered and took me back, but she never did. She never took me back, so that kind of, like, crushed me a little bit. Well, I was waddling almost a little bit in self-pity. I was trying to fool myself and say I wasn't, but I was kind of hurt, feeling sorry for myself just a little bit. And prom time was coming up, and we were hanging out and everything, and my grandmother came to me. She said, what you going to do about your prom, boy? I said, well, Big Mama, I'm going to see if Jerry going to go. She said, well, have you talked to her? I said, well, I'm going to try it one more time. And she said, well, you better get to moving. I think you're about 3 weeks away. Well, I called Jerry. She wasn't having it. Her mind was made up. She was going with her cousin, she said. You know, I was a little boy. Well, I really didn't care. I didn't know what a prom was. I came home. My grandmother said, what the girls say? And they liked Jerry. My whole family always liked Jerry. They thought we was going to do something. I said, Jerry told me no. My grandma said, well, the prom is one of the biggest things in your life, son. You don't want to miss that. I said, well, it don't matter. It really didn't. Ain't nothing but a big dance, you know? She said, son, you got to go. She said, hey, I got an idea. Why don't you ask a little nice girl that you be hanging out with, you and Frazier? That's Big Nigga real name, Morris Frazier. But I call him Big Nigga because he's about 275 pounds, solid, no fat. Been my buddy ever since I was about 12 years old. Well, I said, okay, I'll try it. You know, I talked to my man, Big Nigga, and he told me, man, go ahead, man. She's pretty. She's nice. You know, she didn't like me like a boyfriend, girlfriend. We didn't like each other like that. You know, we hung out, ate, and, you know, we went to a couple of parties and things like that. I was, once again, a little boy. So I called up and I said, hey, what you doing? She said, I'm not doing anything. I said, you got a few minutes? She said, sure, I want to talk to you about something. She said, okay. I said, I'm on my way. I took the bus over there because, see, the bus was what was happening at that time. That gave me some hardcore lessons too. The CTA, they call it, the Chicago Transit Authority. You know, in the cold, in the summer, in the spring, in the fall, you had to be a mean some bitch when you rode the bus. Well, I rode the bus over there to see Rhonda. She let me in. Sweet thing. Sweet little girl. Pretty, too. I came in, and you know what? She was so pretty. I don't know why I was so damn slow in finding her attractive. I was too stupid. Well, I sat down, and I looked at her, and she said, what's up? I said, well, you know, the prom is going to be in a week and a half or so, and I don't have nobody to go with, and I was, you know, kind of thinking that, you know, maybe you might want to go. Well, everybody knew about Jerry. You knew we was class couple. She said, well, what about Jerry? I said, well, Jerry quit me and don't seem like she's coming back. So, and you know, I was hoping you might want to go with me. She said, well, I don't know. And I know Jerry and I don't want her to think that I'm trying to hurt her. And plus, it's going to be hard for me to get a dress and all that kind of stuff. I said, okay. I said, well, I just thought I'd try. She said, well, okay, I'll let you know. It wasn't positive for me. But once again, I guess a little bit of me was wallowing in self-pity. I really didn't care. I walked out, walked down the street to the bus stop, got on the bus,